The preparation, calling, and choosing of Moses. So let's begin by going to the scriptures, and that would be Exodus chapter 2, verse 11. And where we left off last time, and I'll read verses 11 and 12. It says, one day after Moses had grown up, so we talked about his childhood a little bit last time, he went out to where his own people were, and he watched them at their hard labor. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Okay, put your ribbon in there, Exodus, and turn to Acts 7. Acts 7 is where Stephen talks about this same sequence of events and gives us a little bit of additional info. In Acts 7, verse 22 through 24, it says this. Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action. When Moses was 40 years old, he decided to visit his own people, the Israelites, and he saw one of them being mistreated by an Egyptian. So he went to his defense and avenged him by killing the Egyptian. The additional info that we get from Stephen there, from the book of Acts, is interesting. Gives us a little bit of background about, you know, what Moses was up to as a grown man. At that point, Moses was a part of the court of the Pharaoh. He was the son of the Pharaoh's daughter, which sort of described his circumstances. But you could also, maybe that was his title, you know, the son of the Pharaoh's daughter. He would have had access to all the finer things of Egypt, which is the greatest nation on earth at that time, would have been considerable, including a great education. So he would have been a man with sophisticated tastes and sensibilities. And so here he is, he's in his 40s, early 40s perhaps. He would have been at the peak of his career. You know, I remember back in my 40s, and that's it, you know, you are humming along. You've had enough years, you've got experience, but you're not old yet. You're at the peak. It's a really good time. And one of the things that we learn from Stephen is that his career involved words and deeds. He was a man mighty in words and deeds. This first portion of his long life, you know, Moses lived a very long life, which is dealt with very briefly in Scripture, was a time of preparation. It wasn't the only time of preparation, but it was a time of preparation for the role God had in store for him. And in some ways, Moses was similar to Paul, who we're in some ways more familiar with. We spend more time in Scripture talking about Paul than Moses. In some ways, they're similar. Both were highly educated men. And God used their education to good ends. Education can go good or bad, but their education would have helped them to understand, especially understand, the false teachings and the philosophies that surrounded and engulfed God's people. Whether it was Egypt or whether it was first century Judaism, people needed a guide to work their way through the deceptive philosophies that were all around them. Both Moses and Paul, as educated men, would have had skill in the written word and probably the spoken word, which God would use to good effect. He would use the talents and the skills that they had earned elsewhere, and he would use them for his purposes. So education and knowledge can be effective weapons, if you will, for spiritual battle, intellectual battle. And we have to do some of that. We have to defend the faith, and having a good education can be helpful. It's not the only thing in the world, but it can be very helpful. These are two examples of people who were educated and God used their education. You know, someone who's got a lot of education and knowledge can also be used by God to help out in providing guidance and direction, even leadership among God's people. Not the only thing, but it can be very helpful. I mean, if you want help with, you know, counseling about finances. It'd be nice to have someone who's knowledgeable about finances in the congregation. Talk to you about tithing, for example. It's good to know and understand the enemy around you, as I mentioned before, Egypt or the first century Judaism. I think today it's helpful for those who are, especially those who are in a position to teach, those who are in a position to lead discussions and things like that, to know what's happening in the world around them, know what the arguments are, and be able to defend the faith. That's something, I don't think that you have to have an education to be able to do that, but it can help. So God can use your education and he can use your skills. However, education and knowledge can also be a trap. It can be a source of pride. You've probably seen that in your life. It can be a source of pride, vanity. Knowledge, education must be tempered and balanced with humility. And we'll see that in Moses' career as well. In the brief section that we started off with from Exodus, Moses went to see his people. He knew who he was. He knew he was a Hebrew. And for whatever reason, I don't know why, but for some reason, at age 40 plus, Moses went out to see his people. And he didn't like what he saw. They were downtrodden and they were oppressed. Let's go back to Exodus, and there, let's read verses 13 and 15. Okay, so looking this way and that way and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. He murdered the man who was beating the Hebrew. Then, it says, the next day he went out and he saw two Hebrews fighting, and he asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" And the man said, "Who made you a ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid, and he thought, what I have done must have become known. And when Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian. So Moses had responded to what he saw. He saw the Egyptian beating the Hebrew man, and he responded with violence, anger. And let's go once again to Acts 7, and I'm going to take a look at what Stephen says about this. In Acts 7, verse 24, and I'll read through 29, it says, he saw one of them being mistreated by an Egyptian, so he went to his defense and avenged him by killing the Egyptian. Moses thought that his own people would realize that God was using him to rescue them, but they did not. And the next day, Moses came upon two Israelites who were fighting, and he tried to reconcile them by saying, "Men, you are brothers. Why do you want to hurt each other?" But the man who was mistreating the other pushed Moses aside and said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday?" When Moses heard this, he fled to Midian, where he settled as a foreigner, and he had two sons. So Moses, we learned a little bit there from Stephen, Moses saw this reaction that he had of anger leading to violence in a spirit of revenge. He saw this as the path to deliverance. He thought, this is how we're going to escape. This is how we're going to be delivered. Going to fight back. That was his plan. He was responding with violence, anger, leading to deliverance. Wasn't going to work though. We'll come back to that. So let's take one more look at a little bit of commentary that comes from the New Testament. Go to Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11, verse 24. Says, by faith, Moses, when he was grown up, so this is that same part of his life, when he was grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with his people, with the people of God, rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. Now, I added that, I thought that was a worthwhile addition to what we get in the narrative you find in Exodus, because I think Moses' rejection of Egypt and his reaction to what he saw happening didn't happen all at once. I don't think it would have happened all at once. And that phrase that we find in Hebrews, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh, I think could imply a more formal renunciation of his status. You know, he refused to be called son of Pharaoh, which would have been a big deal, because it's a big honor to be called the son of Pharaoh. So I think that means that he was doing other stuff that we don't read about in the narrative there in Exodus, and perhaps he'd made a more formal renunciation. Perhaps he'd even complained about what he'd seen previously. Maybe he'd lodged formal protests against the injustice. He was there in the court. I don't think that, you know, in Exodus it all basically takes place in one sentence, but it's not the sort of thing that happens just like that. You know, a person arrives at a point where they lash out in violence, usually after a simmering period. So I don't know, the rash outburst of violence and vengeance was probably not the beginning of Moses' protest against the treatment of Israel. It was more likely, I think, based on what I know of how we function and operate, that his indignation, his disgust, and his anger built up within him until he lashed out in murder, which is what it was. That was an act of passion. Yep. It was an act of passion. But it was also premeditated. I mean, it says he looked this way. He looked that way. He wanted to see if anyone was looking. Would he be caught? So there's passion, but there's also premeditation involved in it as well. The presumption of Moses. Now, we read a little bit about this in what Stephen had to say. Moses assumed that his people, blah, 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 blah. Well, Moses presumptuously assumed that his people would unify around him. You know, once he'd kind of struck the first blow, everybody would rise up and say, yes, finally! You know, it'd be like, you know, something you'd see in Braveheart or, you know, that kind of thing. He sort of assumed that was what was going to happen. It was an act of revolution, violence, which again, he clearly thought that this was the path to deliverance. He took the law into his own hands. He broke God's command against murder, because it was murder. Now, for a just cause, you might say, for a just cause, but I think it's important for all of us to remember and always and never forget that we will never, ever create justice through unjust means. That's something that's floating around in our society nowadays, that somehow or another we can use unjust means to achieve a just society. And it won't work. It will not work. We'll get an unjust society. It'll just be different. Anyways, Moses also assumed that he could lead Israel to brotherhood, if you will. You know, he came across those two men, both Israelites, fighting. He said, what are you guys doing? You're brothers. Why are you fighting? So I think he thought, you know, he was also going to lead them to brotherhood, as well as freedom and deliverance. Noble sentiments. No one can fault either of those as legitimate goals. Can you? I don't. Brotherhood? Freedom? No, I don't. But noble sentiments that were misdirected and definitely unappreciated. I mean, the quarreling men of Israel, they turned around and asked, oh yeah? Well, who made you boss of me? Right? That's basically what they said. Who put you in charge? Who made you the leader? And I don't think God was pleased with this approach either. But God could, and he would, work with and through Moses to build his holy nation. Because those noble sentiments, they are the goals, part of the goals that God has. But it had to be accomplished a different way. And as an instrument of God, Moses would accomplish things that he himself would have never dreamed of. You know, you find freedom, you seek brotherhood, and it all sounds great, but then when you get into the nitty-gritty of it, of trying to establish a society, it's harder. They didn't have the law, they didn't have the commandments, the guidance they needed from God, but that's another story. Moses would only become the person God could use to deliver his holy nation after some additional training. I mentioned his previous years had been training and preparation for his role, but he needed more. He needed something he did not yet have. He was a great man of words and deed, but the great man of speech and action needed meekness. He needed humility. He needed patience. And he would learn these traits through the next 40 years as a shepherd in the wilderness of Midian. So he had more training to undergo, 40 more years of training. Now, when I've made a number of comments about using violence and seeking justice through violence, and when I was going through this, it made me think of Martin Luther King Jr. That's who came to my mind. And he's rightly revered in our country, not just for what he accomplished, but for how he accomplished it, isn't he? How he accomplished it. The movement that he led was not a violent insurrection. It didn't involve the use of violence. That is why the man is so revered and respected in this country. In fact, if you read up a little bit about it, anyone who wanted to be part of the movement had to be trained. They had to go through training. And what they had to be trained in was how to not respond violently when you were angry, when someone provoked you. And they had to train so that they didn't respond with anger and violence and seek vengeance. Because responding in anger and, you know, using violence and seeking revenge, that's how the flesh and blood mind thinks, isn't it? If you're treated wrong, you're treated badly, that's your response. It's your knee-jerk reaction, isn't it? So it requires training to overcome that. And it takes effort to think and respond otherwise. And Moses needed that kind of extra training. And he was going to get it. So Moses flees to Midian. Let's take a look at the next section of Exodus, which we'll pick up here, starting in the last half of verse 15, and then go through verse 22. It says, Moses fled to live in Midian, and he sat down at a well. Now, a priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water the father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and he came to their rescue and he watered their flock. And when the girls returned to Reuel, their father, he asked them, "Whoa, how have you returned so early today?" So this must have been a common thing. And they answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." "Ho ho, and where is he?" Reuel asked his daughters. "Why did you leave him? Invite him to have something to eat." Moses agreed to stay with the man who gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, which means, "I have become a foreigner in a foreign land." So Moses had good instincts. He seems to have had an instinct for brave intervention on behalf of the weak being pushed around by the strong. Okay? And I think that's probably one of the things that God liked about Moses. You know, I think there's a lot of aspects to his character. I think that's one of the things that God would have said, "You know, I like that, I can work with that. It needs to be, you know, molded and shaped, but I like that, I can work with that." So Moses settles in for the long haul and he marries this woman, Zipporah. But he wouldn't, I think you can tell by the way he names his son that he really didn't allow himself to feel at home there. You know, he was there, he kind of settled in, but he named his son stranger, foreigner. And I think that's telling. Naming his son that way would have been a constant reminder of his great sorrow in exile. He didn't really feel at home in this place called Midian. And we don't have a lot of information, but his marriage, well, his marriage isn't a love story like you get with Rachel or Rebecca. It's kind of transactional, it seems. And the marriage had tensions. Those come out later in chapter 4. We'll have to leave that for a future message. But there you go. Moses has settled in for 40 years. Let's read the next section, which would be verses 23 and through 25. It says, during that long period, the king of Egypt died, and the Israelites groaned in their slavery, and they cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. So, okay, had God forgotten about them and just remembered them now? Is that what this is saying? No. What it means is that now it was time to move forward with the promise of the covenant. Go backwards into Genesis chapter 15, verse 13. Talking about God's covenant with Abraham, it says, then the Lord said to him, know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and that they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But now is time. That time is up. It's time to move forward. And I talked about this a little bit in the previous message that, you know, I think they had a part to play in their enslavement. They were dabbling with Egyptian idolatry, and, you know, I think that led or helped lead to them ending up at the bottom of the heap. But even with that, why had God allowed this to happen? Why have people go through centuries of slavery? You know, it's a big question, and I'm not going to try and answer all the nuances of why God would do this to these people and, you know, cover the whole subject. But let me just bring out a few little points that move the story forward. The years in Egypt, well, they accomplished some what I'll call logistic needs for creating a nation out of the family of Abraham. One, as I described in the previous message, it was kind of an apartheid situation, an apartheid system in Egypt that kept them from simply blending in to the greater population of Egypt and sort of disappearing as a distinct people, okay? You know, good can come out of bad, right? Secondly, I mean, and that assimilation would have happened if they'd stayed in Canaan just as much. They would have just assimilated in with the people, and they would be indistinguishable as sons of Abraham. So that's a logistics thing. Also in Egypt, they grew in numbers. Remember we talked about they had a lot of babies. Well, they grew in numbers to the point where they could be considered a nation. You know, a million people or more. It was a nation. It wasn't just a little band of stragglers. They grew in numbers. They were the size of a nation. And then third, their redemption from bondage. They would come out of Egypt in big numbers. An entire nation would be born overnight, and it would demonstrate the power of God in establishing the holy nation. It wasn't the sum total of their character as people. The burning bush. Back to Exodus. Let's read in chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. It says here, now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. That's another name for this man, Reuel, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the side of the wilderness, to the far side of the wilderness, and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And there the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire within a bush. And Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it didn't burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush doesn't burn up. And when the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, "Moses, Moses." Now, Moses doesn't appear to be searching for God. We don't know, but it doesn't show that he was diligently searching for God. I don't know where he was at spiritually, but God sought Moses out. It's a great example of God's grace, where God takes the initiative. He makes the first move. He found you. He called you before you thought of calling him. And so it is with Moses. God graciously seeks out this man, Moses, who actually had some problems. But God saw him and he loved him. Now the word angel there, when it says the angel was in the bush, that can be a little confusing for some people. I don't know if it is for you, but the word angel there is melech. That's the Hebrew word melech, which simply means a messenger or representative of. So a melech is the representative of God. Okay? So melech does not have to be a cherubim or a seraphim or whatever, but it can be. Okay? I think a good explanation of what's going on here could be that the word, the logos, the one who was God and who was with God, is the one in the bush as a representative of the God family. It's one way, I think, of looking at this. For example, that same word, that same logos, comes again as the representative of God in flesh, and we know him by the name Jesus, right? That's what he was doing. Just go to John 12. Lots of scriptures on this. I kind of had to narrow it down to one that I thought was good out of the many. John 12, verse 44 and 45. Jesus cried out, "Whoever believes in me does not believe in me only, but in the one who sent me. The one who looks at me is seeing the one who sent me. I have come into the world as a light, so that no one who believes in me should stay in darkness." He came as a representative of the Father, as he said to Thomas, for example, "You've seen me, you've seen the Father." He was the representative of the God family. Anyway, I also think it's interesting that God, in the bush, chose not to reveal himself in human form, as he had done with Abraham, as he did with Jacob. Okay, God revealed himself and spoke to them in human form. But he didn't this time. It was a bush. Why? What's with the bush? A lot of people spend time, you know, thinking about what does the bush represent, what's it symbolic of, and not very conclusive to me. A possibility that I thought was interesting is that perhaps the choice of the bush, not human form, was to counteract the whole Egyptian way of thinking about God, okay? And thinking about God in terms of form and appearance. It was a big deal. It's a big deal in most pagan religions, thinking about the form of God, trying to like put it in a picture, put it in a statue, whatever. And that precaution against creating images of God would later be encoded in the second commandment. Now, humans are the true likeness of God, but God wants to be known by his character and his deeds. We've talked about that before. That's what's important to God. I want you to know me by my character and my deeds, not how I look. God had been watching Moses, and he loved him. And he says, "Moses, Moses." And you've heard that repeating of the voice in other places in Scripture, haven't you? Where God says, "Samuel, Samuel." He says it to Paul, who I've mentioned previously. "Saul," that was his, you know, before he changed his name to Paul. "Saul, Saul." Now, when a name is repeated like that in the Semitic culture, that's a term of endearment. It means I love you. It's one of those cultural things that, you know, we don't have that, so we don't pick up on it as quick. But God loved him. Moses, Moses. You see Jesus do this with the apostles as well. They repeat the name. That's what it means. I love you. But Moses might not have felt very loved by God at this point. I mean, here he is. He's exiled from his people. He has no homeland. He's a stranger in a strange land. All his impressive education is focused on herding a smelly bunch of sheep and goats. How's that love? How is that God's love? Go to Hebrews 12. I think we all have ideas about how we want God to love us. They're usually pretty cozy and nice. In Hebrews 12, verses 5 through 8, God talks about his love here. In this setting of a father and a child, he says, "Have you completely forgotten the word of encouragement that addresses you as a father addresses his son? It says, 'My son, don't make light of the Lord's discipline, and don't lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines the one he loves, and he chastens everyone he accepts as his son.' Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as his children. For what children are not disciplined by their father? If you're not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are not legitimate, not true sons and daughters at all." This is God's perspective on love. Maybe not ours, but we kind of need to change the way we think a lot of times, right? God's type of love provides discipline and training and correction. You know, we talked a little bit about areas where Moses needed a little bit of course correction, needed some extra elements. And in this way, God's love provides purpose. But we think of love as providing comfort and good feelings. And, you know, we want that. I want that. You want that too. But it also, God's love provides purpose. And all the trials and the troubles and the sorrows of Moses' life would take on purpose and meaning when applied to the important task God would give him. And that is how you and I should regard the ups and downs of life, which, you know, we have and we share with one another. Faith doesn't mean that you and I are immune to life's trials. What it means is that faith gives us meaning and purpose where formerly we might not have had it. Moving along, take off your shoes. Exodus 3, verses 5 and 6 say this. God says, "Okay, don't come any closer." Well, he says, "Moses, Moses," and then Moses answers, "Here I am." "Do not come any closer," God said. "Take off your sandals, for the place you are standing is holy ground." Then he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob." And at this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. And that's something we see often in the Old Testament, particularly where people are, they have an encounter with God and their first reaction is, "Yikes." And God actually says, that's good. You know, think of the Mount Sinai where the people were afraid to hear his voice. And he said, okay, that's actually a good response. God's demand that Moses take off his shoes is the first inkling of an overarching message in Exodus and in the entire first five books of the Bible. One, how can sinful human beings come into the presence of the Most Holy? And then secondly, how Yahweh, the Most Holy God, can come into the presence of humanity? And the answer, without elaborating too much on it, is, well, keep clean, show respect, and maintain a healthy fear of becoming too familiar. Now Moses' shoes, if you think about his shoes, you think about what he did for a living, his shoes would have been covered with dirt, dust, and goat droppings. So there's a lesson there, a small one. We must not bring our unrighteous passions I mean, I don't think God would appreciate goat droppings either, but taking a more spiritual look at it, we ought not bring our unrighteous passions and our selfish desires into God's presence, unless it's to get rid of them. I mean, you know, Moses had some of that. We've talked about anger, revenge, stuff like that. Second, taking off the shoes is a show of humility, one of the lessons that Moses needed. So an application for us, I think the most obvious application is, how do we come before God? That would cover prayer. How do we come before God in prayer? What's our attitude? What do we bring into his presence? But I think it also applies to the Sabbath, which here we are, we're keeping the Sabbath together. How do we come before him in holy convocation each Sabbath? Do we bring our dirt in with us? Do we show humility and respect? Moses had some stuff he needed to get rid of. He couldn't bring them into God's plan. Moses couldn't bring his desire for revolution and violence and vengeance into the process of God's deliverance. There's really no place for them there. It's not how God wanted to make things happen. Okay, the land. We're in Exodus 3. Let's take a look at verses 7 through 10. They say this. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. So I've come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. So by default, and we talked about this in the previous message, Egypt had become their land. I mean, they'd moved into this place. They'd kind of settled in. They picked up some bad habits. They'd done some bad stuff. But Egypt had kind of become their land. You know, they longed for it when they were in the wilderness. Oh, if we could go back to Egypt. So, you know, it was their land. It was earthy, it was sensual, but it was also difficult and full of trial. But in the unfolding of the covenant, the promises that God had made, beginning with Abraham, God would give them a new land. I'm going to give you a new land. That's a big deal. We don't talk about it very much, but it's a big, 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 big deal. That land would be a gift God was giving them. And the way God's talked about it and the way he structured it, it was a blessing and a gift that no one could take away from them. No one could take the land away from them. But they could give it up themselves. It was their gift to have. They would have it forever. But they could also give it away. Now, you know, it was to be a permanent inheritance, and when you read through the statutes and judgments of God, there are plenty of laws and regulations about land and property and borders and stuff like that. You know, I think, oh, this is kind of tedious. What it's about is about the permanence of your inheritance. You think about those laws about the Jubilee and things like that. It's all about making sure you don't lose your inheritance through the machinations of others, through, you know, just dumbness on your part. But you can give it up. The land was an old covenant type of the new covenant inheritance, which we know is eternal life, which is a gift from the Creator that no one can take away from you. No one can take away what God's given you. But you can give it up. You can give it up yourself. So that's one of the meanings of the land. There's lots to, you know, the Old Testament has lots to say about the land, but it begins here. Many things begin in Exodus. How can I be God's representative? So we're in Exodus. Let's pick it up in verse 11 and read verses 11 and 12. Okay, Moses, here's all this good stuff that God has in store. And he says, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you. I will be with you. And this will be a sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. So here we are. I've talked about Moses and how he needed to kind of become a new person. Moses had lost a lot of his presumption and, you know, seemingly his self-confidence. But in God's eyes, now he was ready. Now he's ready. And now Moses could be trusted to act in such a way that no one would get the idea that deliverance was from his hand or because of his eloquence. It would happen in a way such that everybody knew that it was God's power and God's strength and not the eloquence or acts of a man. And then God also gave Moses a concrete short-term goal. It would come to pass in 3 months there on Mount Sinai. Moses would experience this, and it would be very helpful to him. Moses would understand when this came to pass in 3 short months that it was God's power that had brought them there to Mount Sinai, which is what he's talking about. And Moses would be able to reflect on this event in his life and reflect back on it and its fulfillment in later years. And he would need this. And he would find strength and he would find assurance through all those difficult 40 years in the wilderness and the people who just drove him crazy. He could look back on this signature event and say, yes, God is with me. God is with me. An application for us, not much of a stretch. Remembering what God has done for you in the past can give strength for trials in the present. And I think it's easy for us to say, yeah, yes, yes, but what has God done for me lately? But to remember what God has done for you in the past is a big deal, and it can help you get through the trials of the present. And I think almost everybody has seen God's hand at work, either in your own life or in the lives of others around you. And you know this has happened, and I've heard you talk about it. These are given to you as signs for you so that you remember and you don't forget when times are tough. What shall we call you? Exodus 3, let's take a look at verses 13 through 15. It says, Moses said to God, okay, all right. Suppose I go to the Israelites and I say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And then they ask me, what is his name? What shall I tell them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. Well, Moses asks a question. It's a sensible question, isn't it? A pretty sensible question. I think you'd ask the same question, right? So, what do I call you? And especially in the polytheistic environment of the time, you know, and all these different gods, and they had different names. You couldn't just say God, because people would go, what do you mean? Which one? So his question is, okay, which God are you? And the answer is twofold. One, God says, I am the self-existent one. You know, as it says elsewhere in the New Testament, God is life. I am self-existent. I depend on nothing, nobody. I am life. That's part of what God says. And he also says, I am the God of history and of prophecy. You know, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Okay? I had someone ask me an interesting question about a month ago. They said, why do you refer to God as Yahweh now and then? I don't know if you ever wondered that, but I do that once in a while. That's the Hebrew tetragrammaton, as it's called, of I am. Y-H-W-H. We don't know how to pronounce it, and so Yahweh is a pretty good bet, I think. And I do it because that's God's name. If you look at his name, though, by what it means, I think a really good way to refer to God instead of the Lord, which isn't what it says at all in the Old Testament, probably would be the eternal. So when I say Yahweh, I could say eternal. But that's what he's getting at. I am life, life itself, life everlasting, life ever existing. So let's read on in Exodus 3, verses 16 through 22. It says, go and assemble the leaders of Israel and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, appeared to me and said, I have watched over you and I have seen what has been done to you in Egypt. And I have promised to bring you up out of your misery in Egypt into the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. and the elders of Israel will listen to you. Then you and the elders are to go to the king of Egypt and say to him, 'The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. Let us take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God.' But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand compels him. So I will stretch out my hand and strike the Egyptians with all the wonders that I will perform among them. And after that, he will let you go. And I will make the Egyptians favorably disposed towards this people, so that when you leave, you will not go empty-handed. Every woman is to ask her neighbor and any woman living in her house for articles of silver and gold and for clothing, which you will put on your sons and daughters. And so you will plunder the Egyptians." And they would use all those goodies to basically fund what they were going to do in the wilderness. That's jumping ahead. So that's a brief overview given by God, Yahweh, of how the Exodus will transpire, what's going to happen, including a dramatic demonstration of power, his power over the Egyptian false gods. Moses hesitates. Now, the Bible, one of the really interesting things about the Bible is that the Bible does not idealize its heroes. A hero in the Bible is not like faultless or flawless, perfect. No, they're warts and all. And we see them and their sin and their weaknesses. And that's the case with Moses as well. Let's read chapter 4, verses 1 through 9. It says, Moses answered, because God's told him, here's what's going to happen. Here's how it's going to happen. Moses answers, well, what if they don't believe me or listen to me? And they say, 'The Lord did not appear to you.' Then the Lord said to him, 'Okay, what is that in your hand?' 'A staff,' he replied. And the Lord said, 'Okay, throw it to the ground.' Moses threw it to the ground, and it became a snake, and he ran from it. Then the Lord said to him, 'Reach out your hand and take it by the tail.' So Moses reached out, and he took hold of the snake, and it turned back into a staff in his hand. 'This,' said the Lord, 'is so they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has appeared to you.' Then the Lord said, 'Okay, put your hand inside your cloak.' So Moses put his hand into his cloak, and when he took it out, the skin was leprous. It had become as white as snow. 'Now put it back into your cloak,' he said. So Moses put his hand back into his cloak, and when he took it out, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. Then the Lord said, 'Okay, if they don't believe or pay attention to the first sign, they may believe the second. But if they do not believe these two signs or listen to them, take some water from the Nile and pour it out on dry ground. And the water you take from the river will become blood on the ground.'" So Moses is worried about how things are going to go, how people will respond to him. And what's interesting is that he's more worried about his own people than he is about the Egyptians or the Pharaoh, right? He is worried about, well, what about the people? What are they going to say? He's afraid of his own people. I'm afraid, I don't know if that's the word, but he wants to know, what about them? I think like us, the heroes and the messengers of God are very often most concerned about how they will be viewed by their own people rather than the enemy. And if you think about it, in times of adversity, times are tough, we're asked to do challenging things, we are strengthened by knowing that we're not alone. We are strengthened by knowing we're not alone. You know, there's kind of a Hollywood myth that, you know, one person stands up to the whole world. Yeah. Okay, maybe once in a while. But for the most of us, for the average person like you and me, we are strengthened knowing we're not alone. That we have friends, that we have family, and comrades who support us or will benefit from what we do. That gives us meaning and purpose, right? Gives us courage. I mean, a soldier may have less resilience and less courage to face the enemy if the people that he fights to protect are against him. If you know all the people that you're fighting for hate you, it's hard. But knowing that you have people is helpful, means something to us. An application for us today, okay, look, every one of us needs to take our own stand in this life. You got to stand on your own two feet. No one can carry you or me into the kingdom. But God's given you one another to encourage and to strengthen one another. And that's a benefit that's built right into this gathering on the Sabbath. So don't neglect it. Don't forget it. So to get the people to rally behind Moses, God provides three miraculous signs: the staff, the leper's hand, and the river of blood. They're all, I think, symbolic. The staff, the rod of the shepherd, will overpower the scepter of the Pharaoh. The power of God will be demonstrated through the use of weak agents to confound the mighty. That's a theme we see throughout Scripture. The leper's hand. Well, he carries with him the power of life and death, which they'll see writ large by the time they're done with Egypt. And the third one's the river of blood, which I kind of alluded to last time I was here, saying that that's a sign that God will avenge the murder of their children. Okay, why me? So we're in Exodus. This will be the last section we read. Pick it up in verse 10, and we'll read through verse 17. It says, Moses said to the Lord, "Pardon your servant, Lord. I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you've spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue." The Lord said to him, "Who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Isn't it me, the Lord? Now go, I will help you speak, and I will teach you what to say." But Moses said, "Pardon your servant, Lord. Please send somebody else. Can't you find somebody else to do this?" And then the Lord's anger burned against Moses, and he said, "What about your brother Aaron, the Levite? I know he can speak well. He's already on his way to meet you, and he will be glad to see you. You shall speak to him and put words into his mouth, and I will help both of you speak and will teach you what to do. He will speak to the people for you, and it will be as if it were your own mouth. But take this staff in your hand so you can perform the signs with it." Okay, so the inclusion of Aaron here would have provided Moses moral support, you know? And I think that's important. It kind of plays into the previous point of how we're stronger when we know we've got someone with us. And it would also come at a price, though. Think about it. There was a price for this. I mean, God was not happy. He was angry. And there would be a price to pay. One, Moses' bloodline. He would not receive the priesthood. His sons would not be the priests of God. So that was the cost. Another cost was to the whole nation. Aaron, he was not the leader that Moses was. No way. He was not as tenacious as Moses. Think, for example, of Aaron's passive weakness in the golden calf incident. It tells us that the best speaker is not necessarily the best leader. So earlier we read that Moses was a mighty man in words and deeds, right? But here he says, "Oh, who am I?" So what happened? Had he lost confidence? After 40 years of slugging it out as a shepherd in the wilderness, had he kind of lost his confidence? Was he self-absorbed, maybe? Self-pitying? Remembering how he had been rejected? Maybe he was rejected initially, right? He'd initially been rejected. You know, we can remember back, last time I tried that, things didn't work out very well. Poor me. Maybe he was just taking humility a little bit too far. Don't know. Reluctance to take up a task or a position offered by God is not good. And I've seen, and I've probably even done it myself, "Oh no, not me. Oh no, not me." But why are you saying, "Oh no, not me"? Is it because you know your pride and your vanity don't want to get into a situation where, "Oh, I think people might laugh at me. They might think I'm not good enough"? But to turn down an offer from God is not a good thing. I put it to you that we should all be more fearful of not assuming important roles within the church when they're offered, rather than making a display of sometimes false humility, self-serving humility. A truly meek and a truly humble person will do what God wants. And they will have confidence, but confidence in God and not themselves. And they will be able to fulfill the task given. Now, each and every one of us has been asked by God to do something challenging. I don't know where you are, what your role is, but you've been asked to do something challenging. Some of it's off in the future, and some of it's happening right now. For some, one thing, for others, it's another. Showing hospitality, offering financial support, giving mercy, laboring in prayer, encouraging others in trials, providing teaching within the congregation, helping administer the various tasks that go into pulling off a holy convocation each week. This is the church. That's the church. That's what the church does. The church is you, and it's me, and it's him, and it's her. That's the church. We have to take up the roles that God has given us and do them. And we can. We can. Very early on in his career, Moses put himself forward as a deliverer, right? Based on his own skills and his personal charisma, and that was a failure. Later, after he'd learned humility, put on meekness and patience, God gave him a role. And at that point in his career, Moses would have learned some stuff. One thing he learned is he didn't have everything it would take to make this deliverance happen. So he asked, why me? But God said, I will be with you. I will be with you. So don't hold back. And he says the same thing to you, and to me today.